They always do, yeah.
Do you not like to hear your voice on recording, do you?
I don't mind it. What was a little uncanny last night, my boyfriend and I was testing it out, and we played it back, and I realized I think that we think we sound different. My mother says that we sound the same. And I realized the reason I think we sound different, it's just the amount of difference between my voice as it sounds to me, yeah, talking, and then my voice as it's recorded.
Interesting.
So in fact, when you record both of us on a tape, I can't tell the difference. It's a little mysterious.
You have absolutely no accent, which is a bit weird to me. My initial thought would be that you're from the Midwest, so I wouldn't hear it as an accent, but you don't have any accent at all.
Well, I was born in Texas and then moved to California and then moved to Massachusetts, so...
No, it's not a criticism.
I
would have no idea where you were from. It's kind of good, in a way.
So I guess we lost all that stuff about...
Yeah, okay.
Platonism. What was I asking?
I
was asking about whether it's harder to write abstract, or whether it's... What are the challenges of writing without plots, without bodies?
Well, again, this... I assume the book works. If the book works, there is kind of a story to it, and this was one of the things that was supposed to distinguish it from the unnamed book, is that there isn't some bullshit... ordinary, like, totally sane guy driven mad by forbidden math concept story. But there's a story, and, it starts with Anaximander and Zeno and continues up to the present day. So there is, but I know what you mean. The honest truth, I think of myself as a fiction writer. I don't really know I don't feel like I know very much about how nonfiction works, whether it's, like, travel writing or essays or something like this. And so I think the fact that this was seemed difficult and strange and hard didn't bother me because I'd never done anything like this before. I think I was trying so hard, in a weird way, and you probably encountered this in your work too. There's really only one basic problem in all writing is how to get some empathy with the reader, right? How to get some idea of how much of this paragraph is clear, what effect is this going to have, how to get that empathy without it turning into being manipulative, mm-hmm. right? And that problem is a jewel on which there are many facets, and this is a somewhat different facet. How to take this very, very abstract stuff, boil it down enough so that it fits in a pop book without turning it into pap. Right? Mm-hmm. How to give the reader enough of the real story so you're not lying to them, but also to compress it and make it clear enough so that it's not just understandable but halfway enjoyable for somebody who hasn't studied math for 20 years. It's really not completely different from How do you get a reader to inhabit the consciousness of a character who, say, isn't a hero or isn't a very nice guy, and feel that person's humanity and something of his 3D contours while not pretending that he's not a monster? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not really, I don't think, all that different. Now, here, what I was worried about was all that, oh, my God, have I made this clear? Do I need more on this? Or, my God, will the reader's eyes glaze over? Will the reader now throw the book at the wall because there's one more complication about differential equations? And there were a lot of those. How much can I tell the reader? How much can I tell the reader without boring her or making her feel talked down to? Within the exponent on that is how to pitch the book so that maybe somebody who's had 5 semesters of math can enjoy it, and at the same time somebody who hasn't had really any college math at all might enjoy it. There was that ball in the air too, and I don't know whether the book succeeded. It may be that you need more of a math background for this book than I was hoping that you did. But that was the extra sort of complication.
Yeah.
And again, I'm sorry, it's going to be very hard for you to boil these down. In fairness to me, these are difficult questions. This isn't just... how many months did you spend working on the book?
Pardon?
You know, questions like that. Well, no, not supposed to. These are interesting questions, but I don't know how you're going to get a newspaper article out of it.
I don't know. That's Alex's risk that he took in asking me to write it. Well, you do have one. Do you have one character? You have Robert Gortz. Is he a real person?
There is no single human being with that name. He is a conflation of three different people, two of whom were math teachers.
Are you in touch with any of them?
Yes.
Have they read the book? Are they giving you any feedback?
No, not as of yet. They know they're going to get a copy.
Why do you call it a booklet?
Oh, yeah. Jesse gave me shit about that, too. Because these were supposed to be short books. And this really is. Given the amount of stuff that this covers, this is kind of a booklet. I don't know. A book about this would be difficult to carry. But Jesse wanted me to change it. I think all I did was change it a couple times, which just made the times when the word booklet appears more confusing. I think I needed to call it that because otherwise it was going to be 3,000 pages long and would have taken me 10 years.
Okay.
I probably ought to say off the record, but I don't know. Whatever. That's the truth. That's probably a fuck up to still have the word booklet in.
I should ask you a few Boston questions. Because since we're writing for Boston, I don't know, do you miss being in Boston? Do you?
I miss parts of Brighton and Alston in the Back Bay very much. And in fact, I listened to a couple games of the series on the radio, and it made me very nostalgic. But I lived there for only 3 years, and I moved away over a decade ago. So I was back once, but it was one of those airport bookstore days. Hmm.
It doesn't tempt you?
Oh, well, I'll go back at some point. Sure. Ride the B train?
Yeah. Alex, my editor, Alex Starr, thinks that Infinite Jest should really be understood as a Boston novel. He thinks that, you know, that's the way, that's the key to all keys.
I think a lot of the dialect in there probably doesn't make much sense if you don't know Boston. Boston made a big impression on me because linguistically, it's very different from where I'm from.
And Alex is also fascinated by the Whitey Sorkin connection, whether he's meant to be representative of Whitey or inspired by Whitey Bulger.
I think if you use the name Whitey is rare enough so that I don't know that I thought that through entirely. I think when that book was being written, I don't know that Whitey Bulger certainly wasn't a nationally infamous figure the way he is now. I don't think Whitey Sorkin is supposed to be an isomorphic, unique mapping of Whitey Bulger. But, I mean, when I was in Boston, I don't know whether it was true or not, but there were rumors that Whitey Bulger had it fixed so that his people won the lottery. I mean, what... At least in the parts of Boston in which I was moving, Whitey Bulger was a creature of myth. And there's some story, him and the brother. I mean, I'm sure there's books in the works, but it's an extraordinary story.
Yeah, it's because... I remember that story at the time.
Sorkin is also the name of an academic television critic, I remember, too. I mean, there's some gag about conflating those two names that was probably gettable by exactly one person, and that was me.
Okay. another thing, this is a little... The epigraph, the Greek, the person, not the person in the head, but the person...
You have Greek?
not really. I mean, I did at one point, but what's it from? Is it?
It's made up. It's made up. It is not what's inside your head. It's what your head's inside. It's a gag. The editor threw me a bone. I think the editor thought it was some really esoteric.
It sounds very
ancient, Greek,
Socratic,
doesn't it?
A little more Socratic. Doesn't
it? Yeah, I got a big kick. Yeah, it was a big deal to get him to get the diacriticals right and all that kind of stuff. You're not your average newspaper guy in a pork pie hat who shambles up, smelling of gin.
I'll try to do better.
You don't even have to use tape. What is your background a little bit? You seem like... turn it off for a second. I'm just curious. What am I dealing with here?
You don't...
Why?
What?
Well, no.
It doesn't matter.
This is for Alex.
Talking about me.
I don't mean to... Lingua Franca seemed interesting because half of the time it would be articles like in that anthology, which is like... I'll tell you, I bought that for my dad for Christmas. I mean, I really, really... And then the other half would be... unbelievably venomous, petty, academic backbiting stuff that reminded me of like Dallas or Falcon Crest or whatever. And it was I don't think I even knew it existed till like the last year it was alive or something, but it would have been quite something to track through time. It's certainly different from the fucking Chronicle of Higher Education. You guys must be sad that it's.
It was sad that it
did. You had a deep pockets guy who like lost all his money or bailed out or something.
Yeah, there was an awkward thing.
You can't get somebody else to like step in.
No, well, eventually what happened was the Chronicle bought the in the bankruptcy court. The Chronicle went in and bought the name, and I think right now the Chronicle owns. Yeah, I think it was to put the wood stake through the vampire's heart.
The Chronicle was that threat.
If you type in, on the web, www.linguafranca.com, you get the Chronicle of Higher Ed's webpage.
Well, so, that's something of a compliment, did they?
Yeah, they cared enough.
Interesting.
So you
just went there with Alex? You went to the Globe with Alex?
I'm not actually at the Globe. I'm just a freelancer.
Okay.
I teach some. So, yeah. That's what...
Early American, like, how early? Pre-Irving?
Pardon?
Like Irving era? Like?
Yeah, like from Revolution to Civil War, basically. Yeah.
It's quite a special...
my field. What was I asking? Oh, the Greek.
It's not as much fun talking about yourself, is it?
No. It's terrible. Don't know where to go next.
That'd be a hard specialty to get a teaching job in, though, right? Well, but if you can teach other stuff, too. Anyway, whatever. No, Pomona's looking for medievalists. They're in
really
medievalists right now.
Can't help you out there.
You wouldn't like Southern California very much, either.
No.
Since you're not the average reporter, I'll tell you, I could do a somewhat better job of this. I've had like 2 hours of sleep. And that's why I'm worried that all of this just sounds like Ophelia's Mad Monologue or something. We got in at 2, there's construction outside, I don't know what happened. I had to go do something else with this editor at like, anyway, so I'm sorry. And you're gonna have to do some hewing and chopping.
But if you if you want to add something later, I mean, is there? I have questions that I've sort of asked obliquely, but is there something that I haven't brought up that you want to talk about?
I don't think so. Although, if you're interested in the series or what the rhetorical agenda of these books is supposed to be, Jesse Cohen is. I mean, I'm not just flogging the series.
Yeah.
He's The best part about, and this isn't for the article, this is he's actually really good, and mm-hmm. kind of a mensch. You should talk to him. He's smart. And he's, I think, the driving force behind this series. I think Atlas kind of went out and got the money, but I think Jesse was kind of the assistant on Penguin Lives, and now this is his baby, and he uh-huh. can talk real interestingly about it. I can tell you're fascinated about that. Yeah.
That angle. Well,
and if you would like to put in the article, just as somebody who grew up 2 hours south of Chicago and suffered with the Cubs for, I'm just so sorry. I have an idea of what. I mean, I went to some games at Fenway and stuff. I can't think of it, even though it was probably one of the great pennant series ever, and will like go down in history. The city must be heartbroken. I mean, I was literally sick when the Cubs didn't cut the mustard. Finally, you just knew when they were up 3-1. You just knew. You just knew. Anyway.
I'm sorry about that.
But if it was like Atlanta or something, you wouldn't care. But Jesus, Boston. And the people for whom that is the religion. Anyway.
The one question I guess I haven't really talked about is the whole... You have a line where you say analogies to certain ideas of God are obvious. I don't know if I have a question or just sort of like...
I think that's in the...
Is there a way to...
I mean, it's... The book is rather odd because there's kind of the opening Straw Boater and Cain chapter where you're kind of trying to give a general overview about why this whole thing is going to be kind of mind-bending. I think the idea is that... that in the anthropology of religion, you basically build an idea of God by simply removing all the limitations you see, all the limitations and imperfections you see in the real world around you. Is that what we're talking about? And that infinity is kind of the same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. Everything's limited. Imagine something without that.
Yeah.
Probably a Kronekarian would say, infinity and God are sort of the same sort of thing. They're pie-in-the-sky dreams of people who haven't adjusted to the ineluctability of limit in the universe, mm-hmm. and so like to dream of something without that. And it's really just a unicorn. They're just sticking various concepts together and it doesn't come out. You have an odd facial expression when the person's answering the question because it usually looks like stark incomprehension. It's just this. Did that make any sense at all? I mean, am I?
Yeah.
Is the part of the book that I think your question's referring to what it's referring to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a part in Infinite Jest. I don't know which character it is, talking about having trouble with the higher power and AA. And having to accept that it's just, I think it's Gately, that if he has a merely technical response, it will eventually work.
Interesting.
And I was sort of relating that to the idea of infinity as being mysterious, and then Cantor coming along and sort of having this technical apparatus for kind of interfacing with it.
My guess, and I I've got to confess I don't remember Infinite Jest very well, is that Gately's talking about certain spiritual realities and what you have to do to cultivate a relationship in a church-going or 12-step program-going versus, you could say then that the whole agenda of this book is very diametrically different. It's, we want not just to have a technical understanding of this, right? I mean, because it really could be a booklet and could start at the last chapter and simply give you these. And there's a certain interest about it. And in fact, you really don't need calculus to understand, for instance, Cantor's diagonalization. Helps to know a little bit about philosophy of math when you get into Cantor's paradox and the continuum hypothesis and stuff. Much of the stuff in the book that's hard in a math way is just providing context. Cantor just didn't wake up one morning and decide to do this. He was very much part of his math world. And to be honest, the whole reason for doing that is that it was the only way to write about this in a way that hadn't been done before.
Hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And seemed to me to be somewhat worthwhile and was an interesting challenge. But I sure wouldn't say, don't read, if you're interested in Cantor, just read the last chapter. I don't think you can really understand Cantor if you don't know something about Dedekind and the Schnitt method, because the two of them, well, whatever, they're really twin towers. And I don't know whether it's Dedekind or Dedekind, but he doesn't get much billing. You know, nobody now talks about him. He did a lot more for making math, for solidifying math, because he really came. He came up with a way to define irrationals that absolutely clean as a whistle. Whereas Cantor, codifies the transfinite, but Cantor's paradox is the first step into Gödel's incompleteness and self-reference, and it's at once this beautiful climax of the 200 years before it, and the first note of the funeral dirge for math is something that you can just, you know what, we can explain the entire universe mathematically. All we have to do is come up with the right axioms and the right derivation rules. I mean, Cantor's paradox starts the wheel of self-reference. I don't know if you know much about Gödel's incompleteness theorem, but in a lay sense, Gödel is able mathematically to come up with a theorem mm-hmm. that says, I am not provable.
Right.
And it's a theorem, which means that math is either not consistent or it's not complete, by definition, like right. packed in. He is the devil for math. I mean, yeah, your article isn't going to be... I mean, that's a really, really, really simplified way of putting it. But Cantor's paradox, that whole, if it's not a member of the set, it is a member of the set. And then Russell's paradox about 20 years later, those were the first two... You know, when you start coming on a really interesting theme in a piece of music, you usually hear it in kind of echo notes that foreshadow it. Those are the foreshadowings. And I don't imagine Gödel would have come up with the self-reference loop if it hadn't been for Cantor and Russell. Whatever. You're not interested. But there's something...
So it was kind of like if, when some of the technical questions about infinity are answered, this other abyss opens up.
Yeah. And this... The technical question... I mean, infinity was the great albatross for math, really ever since calculus. I mean, infinitesimals... were horseshit, and everybody knew they were horseshit. But the limits thing used natural language stuff like approaches, which math isn't supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's this great shell game, and Weierstrass, Dedekind, and Cantor close all those holes. And it's beautiful, and at the same time, they open what ended up being a much worse one. And that's Gödel. And that's why, if you want to talk about the story of this, it's an incredible story. Probably a really good book on this would be about Gödel and Cantor. It wouldn't work in the series because they want one of each. But anybody who likes this book should then go read the Gödel book. Mm-hmm. I assume it'll be good. Because after Gödel, I mean, the idea that mathematics was not just the language of God, but a language we could decode to understand the universe and understand everything, I mean, that doesn't work anymore. It's part of the great postmodern uncertainty that we live in. Very few people know about it.
Yeah. That's a chilling way for the book to end.
Well, and the book ends very abruptly because you come to the shore of an ocean I'm not even going to dip a toe into, because then we're into 300 more pages. But if the other writer can pull off an interesting, non-condescending book about Gödel, it'll be quite something. Because it's really the great story of math in the last 100 years. And it's also incredibly technical. I mean, how he did. This is hardcore math logic.
I think I tried to understand that at one point in my life and failed.
Pynchon's got 3 or 4 Gödel references in Gravity's Rainbow.
Really?
It's one of the Ur texts for Gravity's Rainbow.
What a long time since I was. What fiction are you working on now? How is that going?
Just this morning, delivered the post-editing draft of a book of, I guess they're short, most of them are kind of novella-ish length, so that'll probably come out like in a year or so, and then other stuff is underway that who knows whether it will even be any good or not, so who knows.
Is there anything you can say about either the story collection or the other stuff, as far as what it is, or brief interviews with?
Yeah, this is much that this.
Coherent.
Yeah, that was more like a cycle. This is more sort of a collection. I think all but a couple have been in magazines, although not all under my name. I don't know. I think it's about as long as brief interviews. It's pretty different, though.
Hmm.
I don't think any of the stories have footnotes, which I'm rather proud of. Got that monkey off my back.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
The monkey was very much in evidence in this book because.
Huh.
Well, just because you want to be able sometimes, if somebody's more interested, to deliver more stuff. But yeah, this was the final footnote heavy touch.
That's interesting. This is a question I just thought was too embarrassing to ask, but because you make fun of Harold Bloom at one point, but. I wondered if this was in some way an ascesis. You know, there's that stage that he talks about.
What is...
Which is like the
this
purging.
Is an anxiety of influence?
Yeah. Which, yeah.
Refresh me on the word.
I forget exactly, but it's like this sort of later stage of an artist's development where he's kind of purging his style of all of the... It's sort of interesting you say, because you kind of overdose on the footnotes here, and if you're going into...
Gosh, I don't know. You know, a lot of the footnote thing was just, I think Infinite Jest was the first book I did on a computer. And on typewriters, footnotes are an immense pain in the ass, right?
Right.
I don't know if you're even old enough to remember, but you got to like measure and make a pencil line and leave room. And it became this really neat thing to kind of have a schizoid narrative voice, but it's got dangers, and I think it's justified in this, even though maybe it's annoying. There are not only footnotes in this book, there are those IYI optional footnotes, and then the non-ones,
right.
It gets a little,
right.
Probably gets a little top-heavy. But it seems like it's a very congenial format for this. The trick is to make the footnotes sort of human-voiced enough so that somebody would actually want to read them instead of it being the dreaded stuff at the bottom, you know, like the footnote-y stuff. Like,
right.
I hate footnotes like that.
Right.
But I don't know about you. I rarely have just one voice in my head. And it's just the easiest way to put more than one voice in your head. But it does. It becomes addictive. And it can mess with you as a storyteller. You know?
So it's not... it's not in the new collection?
Not so much. But only because I think none of the stories worked in the way where you'd want to have. I think one story maybe has a couple... asterisk footnotes. You know, there are so few of them that you can use asterisks in the little... Are those daggers?
Uh-huh.
Are they the dagger costume?
Right.
So, anyway. I don't know. Ascesis is a really good word. I'll certainly use it.
Okay.
I don't know what it's like for you. I don't really have much sense of what my work is like and how it changes and how it doesn't. It's like knowing what you look like in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Or what your voice sounds like in your head. I've quit smoking now. I may never write again.
that'll pass.
How long did it take? How long did it take for you to be able to work comfortably?
The next time I had a deadline,
yeah, well,
it was sort of, I sort of had to get over it.
Yeah. How long before you enjoyed it?
Did you smoking?
Did you smoke while you worked usually? Or?
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes it harder. See, I actually was much more addicted to chewing tobacco than cigarettes. But I would chew while I worked, yeah, and now I just, like, I don't know. Yeah. How many toothpicks can you put in?
Right.
It's just...
Right. No, it's grueling. It's... But it does seem to... The physical craving seems to stop after.
Oh, that's the least of it.
Really?
For me, yeah.
It was the physical and then the associations.
How long has it been for you?
Oh, a long time.
Well, you're not that old.
8-9 years.
So you didn't smoke that long?
Like 4 or 5 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm to be pitied much more than you.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else you want to throw in on the record?
I did not have sex with that intern. I don't know. I know I can't think of it. These are good. You're good. These are good questions. I think you're going to be punished for them by having to, you know. Just don't do the thing of, like, taking one word from one sentence. And,
you know. Okay. I'll try to.
It would be nice. It would be nice not to be humiliated. But for some reason, I feel like you're pretty trustworthy.
Well, do you want? I can give you my email if there's something you want to clarify later. Or...
I'm not going to remember it very well. Probably.
Well, you could reach me through Marianne Brown, I guess.
Well, do you have a? Yes, you have a pencil. I can. Let me give you my office number at Pomona, and I check those messages just about every day.
Okay.
So I think it's more apt to be like, oh, you said something that's interesting. Unfortunately, it makes no sense. Can you rephrase this?
Okay.
It's 909-607-8357.
Okay.
And then, you know what? Leave a good phone number for you if you want me to call you back. And
okay.
Probably, I'd say 48 hours on the outside. Before
okay.
I got back to you. I mean, I may miss a day of checking messages there.
Okay.
But
I think I'm supposed to turn this around by, like, Tuesday.
Okay, I'll be...
So
I will...
I have a question for the...
I will check messages either Sunday night or Monday.
Okay.
So...
We'll see.
It's the best I can do.
Great.
Well, we both lived.
Thank you.